The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert Heinlein. Continued. Disc 10. I venture to suggest that this solution is one we can work with.
Well, okay. But why weren't we told? Stu, did you know?
Huh, no, Manny. There was no reason to tell me.
He shrugged.
I'm a monarchist. I wouldn't have been interested. But I go along with proof that in this day and age elections are a necessary ritual.
Proof said, Manuel, it wasn't necessary to tell us till we got back. You and I had other work to do. Comrade Adam and dear Comrade Wyoming handled it in our absence. So let's find out what they did before we judge what they've done.
Sorry. Well, Wyo?
Manny, we didn't leave everything to chance. Adam and I decided that a Congress of 300 would be about right. Then we spent hours going over the party lists, plus prominent people not in the party. At last we had a list of candidates, a list that included some from the ad hoc Congress. Not all were yammerheads. We included as many as we could. Then Adam phoned each one and asked him, or her, if he would serve, binding him to secrecy in the meantime. Some we had to replace. When we were ready, Adam spoke on video, announced that it was time to carry out the party's pledge of free elections, set a date, said that everybody over 16 could vote, and that all anyone had to do to be a candidate was to get 100 chops on a nominating petition and post it in Old Dome, or the public notice place for his warren. Oh yes, 30 temporary election districts, 10 congressmen from each district. That let all but the smallest warrens be at least one district.
So you had it lined up and party ticket went through?
Oh, no, dear. There wasn't any party ticket, officially. But we were ready with our candidates, and I must say my still Yagi did a smart job getting chops on nominations. Our optings were posted the first day. Many other people posted. There were over 2,000 candidates. But there was only 10 days from announcement to election, and we knew what we wanted, whereas the opposition was split up. It wasn't necessary for Adam to come out publicly and endorse candidates. It worked out. You won by 7,000 votes, dear, while your nearest rival got less than 1,000.
I won?
You won? I won? Professor won? Comrade Clayton won? And just about everybody we thought should be in the Congress. It wasn't hard, although Adam never endorsed anyone. I didn't hesitate to let our comrades know who was favored. Simon poked his finger in, too. And we do have good connections with newspapers. I wish you had been here election night, watching the results. Exciting.
How did you go about nose counting? Never known how election works. Write names on a piece of paper?
Oh, no. We used a better system. Because, after all, some of our best people can't write. We used banks for voting places, with bank clerks identifying customers and customers identifying members of their families and neighbors who didn't have bank accounts. And people voted orally, and the clerks punched the votes into the bank's computers, with the voter watching. And results were all tallied at once in Luna City Clearinghouse. We voted everybody in less than 3 hours, and results were printed out just minutes after voting stopped.
Suddenly, a light came on in my skull, and I decided to question Wyo privately. No, not Wyo. Mike. Get past his Adam Celine dignity and hammer truth out of his neuristers. Recalled a check $10 million too large and wondered how many had voted for me. 7,000? 700? Or just my family and friends? But no longer worried about new Congress. Proof had not slipped them a cold deck, but one that was frozen solid. Then Dr. Earthside while crime was committed. No use asking why. She didn't even need to know what Mike had done, and could do her part better if did not suspect. Nor would anybody suspect. If was one thing all people took for granted, was conviction that if you feed honest figures into a computer, honest figures come out. Never doubted it myself, till I made a computer with sense of humor. Changed my mind about suggesting that Stu be let in on Mike's self-awareness. 3 was 2 too many. Or perhaps 3. I started to say and changed to, "My word, sounds efficient. How big did we win?" Adam answered without expression. 86% of our candidates were successful, approximately what I had expected. Approximately my false left arm, exactly what expected, Mike, old ironmongery. Withdrawal objection to noon session. I'll be there.
It seems to me, said Stu, assuming that the embargo starts at once, we will need something to maintain the enthusiasm we witnessed tonight, or there will be a long, quiet period of increasing economic depression. From the embargo, I mean, and growing disillusionment.
Adam, you first impressed me through your ability to make shrewd guesses as to future events. Do my misgivings make sense?
They do.
Well? Adam looked at us in turn, and was almost impossible to believe that this was a false image.
And Mike was simply placing us through binaural receptors.
Comrades, it must be turned into open war as quickly as possible. Nobody said anything. One thing to talk about war, another to face up to it. At last I sighed and said, "When do we start throwing rocks?"
"We do not start," Adam answered. "They must throw the first one. How do we antagonize them into doing so? I will reserve my thoughts to the last. Comrade Manuel?"
Don't look at me. Way I feel, would start with a nice big rock smack on Agra. A bloke there who is a waste of space. But not what you are after."
"No, it is not,"
Adam answered seriously. "You would not only anger the entire Hindu nation, a people intensely opposed to destruction of life, but you would also anger and shock people throughout Earth by destroying the Taj Mahal."
"Including me," said Prof.
"Don't talk dirty, Manuel."
"Look," I said, "didn't say to do it. Anyhow, could miss Taj."
"Manuel," said Prof. "As Adam pointed out, our strategy must be to antagonize them into striking the first blow. The classic Pearl Harbor maneuver of game theory. A great advantage in Weltpolitik. The question is how. Adam, I suggest that what is needed is to plant the idea that we are weak and divided, and that all it takes is a show of force to bring us back into line. Stu, your people Earthside should be useful. Suppose the Congress repudiated myself and Manuel. The effect?"
"Oh, no," said Wyo.
"Oh, yes, dear Wyo. Not necessary to do it, but simply to put it over news channels to Earth. Perhaps still better to put it out over a clandestine beam attributed to the Terran scientists still with us, while our official channels display the classic stigmata of tight censorship. Adam?"
"I'm noting it as a tactic which probably will be included in the strategy, but it will not be sufficient alone. We must be bombed."
"Adam," said Dwayo, "why do you say so? Even if Luna City can stand up under their biggest bombs, something I hope never to find out, we know that Luna can't win an all-out war. You've said so many times. Isn't there some way to work it out so that they will just plain leave us alone?"
Adam pulled at right cheek, and I thought, "Mike, if you don't knock off play-acting, you'll have me believing in you myself." Was annoyed at him and looked forward to a talk, one in which I would not have to defer to Chairman Celine.
"Comrade Wyoming," he said soberly, "it's a matter of game theory in a complex, non-zero-sum game. We have certain resources or pieces in the game, and many possible moves. Our opponents have much larger resources and a far larger spectrum of responses. Our problem is to manipulate the game so that our strength is utilized toward an optimax solution, while inducing them to waste their superior strength and to refrain from using it at maximum. Timing is of the essence, and the gambit is necessary to start a chain of events favorable to our strategy. I realize this is not clear, I could put the factors through a computer and show you. Or you can accept the conclusion. Or you can use your own judgment. It was reminding Weil, under Stu's nose, that he was not Adam Selene, but Mike, our dinkum thinkum, who could handle so complex a problem because he was a computer, and smartest one anywhere. Weil backtracked.
No, no, she said. I wouldn't understand the maths. Okay, it has to be done. How do we do it?
Was 400 before we had a plan that suited Prof and Stu as well as Adam? Or took that long for Mike to sell his plan while appearing to pull ideas out of the rest of us? Or was it Prof's plan with Adam Selene as salesman? In any case, we had a plan and calendar. One that grew out of master strategy of Tuesday, 14 May, 2075. And varied from it only to match events as they actually had occurred. In essence, it called for us to behave as nastily as possible while strengthening impression that we could be awfully easy to spank. Was at community hall at noon, after too little sleep, and found I could have slept 2 hours longer. Congressman from Hong Kong could not make it that early despite tube all the way. Wyo did not bang gavel until 14:30. Yes, my bride wife was chairman pro tem in a body not yet organized. Parliamentary rulings seemed to come naturally to her, and she was not a bad choice. A mob of loonies behaves better when a lady bangs gavel. Not going to detail what new Congress did and said that session and later, minutes are available. I showed up only when necessary and never bothered to learn talk-talk rules. Seemed to be equal parts common politeness and ways in which chairman could invoke magic to do it his, her way. No sooner had Weil banged them to order, but a cobber jumped up and said,
Gajba Jha, chairman, move we suspend rules and hear from comrade Professor De La Paz,
which brought a whoop of approval.
Weil banged again.
Motion is out of order and member from Lower Churchill will be seated. This house recessed without adjourning, and chairman of committee on permanent organization, resolutions, and government structure still has the floor.
Turned out to be Wolfgang Korsakov, member of Taiko Wonder, and a member of Prof. Cell, and our number one finagler of Luno Hoko. And he not only had floor, he had it all day, yielding time as he saw fit, i.e., picking out whom he wanted to speak, rather than letting just anyone talk. But nobody was too irked. This mob seemed satisfied with leadership. We're noisy, but not unruly. By dinner time, Luna had a government to replace co-opted provisional government, i.e., dummy government we had opted ourselves, which sent Prof and me to Earth. Congress confirmed all acts of provisional government, thus putting face on what we had done, thanked outgoing government for services, and instructed Wolfgang's committee to continue work on permanent government structure. Prof was elected President of Congress, an ex officio Prime Minister of interim government until we acquired a constitution. He protested age and health, then said would serve if could have certain things to help him, too old and too exhausted from trip earthside to have responsibility of presiding, except on occasions of state. So he wanted Congress to elect a speaker, and speaker pro tem. And besides that, he felt that Congress should augment its numbers by not more than 10% by itself electing members at large, so that Prime Minister, whoever he might be, could opt cabinet members or ministers of state who might not now be members of Congress, especially ministers without portfolio, to take load off his shoulders. They balked. Most were proud of being congressmen and already jealous of status, but Prof just sat looking tired and waited, and somebody pointed out that it still left control in hands of Congress. So they gave him what he asked for. Then somebody squeezed in a speech by making it a question to chair. Everybody knew, he said, that Adam Selene had refrained from standing for Congress on grounds that chairman of emergency committee should not take advantage of position to elbow way into new government. But could Honorable Chairlady tell member
whether was any reason not to elect Adam Selene a member at large? As gesture of appreciation for great services? To let all Luna, yes, and all those earthworms, especially ex-lunar ex-authority, know that we are not repudiating Adam Selene? On contrary, he was our beloved elder statesman, and was not president simply because he chose not to be? More whoops that went on and on. You can find in minutes who made that speech, but one gets you 10, Proof wrote it, and Weil planted it. Here is how it wound up, over course of days. Prime Minister and Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, Professor Bernardo de la Paz. Speaker, Finn Nielsen. Speaker pro tem, Wyoming Davis. Undersecretary of State for Foreign Affairs and Minister of Defense, General O'Kelly Davis. Minister of Information, Terence Sheehan. Sheeny turned Pravda over to managing editor to work with Adam and Stu. Special Minister without Portfolio in Ministry of Information, Stuart René Lajoie, Congressman at Large. Secretary of State for Economics and Finance and Custodian of Enemy Property, Wolfgang Korsakov. Minister of Interior Affairs and Safety, Comrade Clayton Watanabe. Minister without Portfolio and Special Advisor to Prime Minister, Adam Selene. Plus a dozen ministers and ministers without portfolio from Warrens other than Luna City. See where it left things? Brush away fancy titles, and B-Cell was still running things, as advised by Mike, backed by a Congress in which we could not lose a test vote, but did lose others we did not want to win, or did not care about. But at time could not see sense in all that talk-talk. During evening session, Prof reported on Trip, and then yielded to me, Committee Chairman Korsakov consenting, so that I could report what five-year plan meant and how authority had tried to bribe me. I'll never make a speaker, but had time during dinner break to swat speech Mike had written. He had slanted it so nastily that I got angry all over again, and was angry when I spoke, and managed to make it catching. Congress was ready to riot by time I sat down. Prof stepped forward, thin and pale, and said quietly, "Comrade members, what shall we do? I suggest, Comrade Korsakov consenting, that we discuss informally how to treat this latest insolence to our nation." One member from Novalin wanted to declare war, and they would have done so right then if Prof had not pointed out that they were still hearing committee reports. More talk, all bitter. At last, Comrade Member Chang Jones spoke.
"Fellow Congressman, sorry, Gospodin Chairman Korsakov, I'm a rice and wheat farmer. Mean I used to be, because back in May I got a bank loan, and sons and I are converting to variety farming. We are broke. Had to borrow Tupfe to get here. But family is eating, and someday we might pull square with bank. At least I'm no longer raising grain. But others are. Catapult has never reduced headway by one barge whole time we've been free. We still shipping, hoping their checks will be worth something someday. But now we know. They've told us what they mean to do with us. To us. I say only way to make those scoundrels know we mean business is stop shipments right now. Not another ton, not a kilo, until they come here and dicker honestly for honest price."
Around midnight they passed embargo, then adjourned subject to call standing committees to continue. Wyo and I went home, and I got reacquainted with my family. Was nothing to do. Mike, Adam, and Stu had been working on how to hit them with it earthside, and Mike had shut Catapult down. Technical difficulties with ballistic computer, 24 hours earlier. Last barge in trajectory would be taken by Puna ground control in slightly over one day, and Earth would be told, nastily, that was last they would ever get. 22. Shock to farmers was eased by continuing to buy grain at Catapult. But checks now carried printed warning that Lunar Free State did not stand behind them. Did not warrant that Lunar Authority would ever redeem them, even in scrip, etc., etc. Some farmers left grain anyhow. Some did not. All screamed. But with nothing they could do, Catapult was shut down. Loading belts not moving. Depression was not immediately felt in rest of economy. Defense regiments had depleted ranks of ice miners so much that selling ice on free market was profitable. Lunahoko Steel subsidiary was hiring every able-bodied man it could find, and Wolfgang Korsakov was ready with paper money. National dollars, printed to resemble Hong Kong dollar, and in theory, pegged to it. Luna had plenty of food, plenty of work, plenty of money. People were not hurting. Beer, betting, women, and work went on as usual. Nationals, as they were called, were inflation money, war money, fiat money, and were discounted a fraction of a percent on day of first issue, concealed as exchange service charge. They were spendable money and never did drop to zero, but were inflationary, and exchange reflected it increasingly. New government was spending money it did not have. But that was later. Challenge to Earth, to authority, and Federated Nations was made intentionally nasty. FN vessels were ordered to stay clear of Luna by 10 diameters and not orbit at any distance under pain of being destroyed without warning. No mention of how, since we could not. Vessels of private registry would be permitted to land if A. permission was requested ahead of time with ballistic plan, B. a vessel thus cleared placed itself under Luna ground control, Mike, at a distance of 100,000 kilometers while following approved trajectory, and C. was unarmed save for 3 handguns permitted 3 officers. Last was to be confirmed by inspection on landing, before anybody was allowed to leave ship, and before ship was serviced with fuel and or reaction mass. Violation would meet confiscation of ship. No person allowed to land at Luna other than ship's crew in connection with loading, unloading, or servicing, save citizens of Terran countries who had recognized Free Luna. Only Chad, and Chad had no ships. Prof expected some private vessels to be re-registered under Chad merchant flag. Manifesto noted that Terran scientists still in Luna could return home in any vessel which conformed to our requirements. It invited all freedom-loving Terran nations to denounce wrongs done us, and which the authority planned against us, recognize us, and enjoy free trade and full intercourse, and pointed out that there were no tariffs or any artificial restrictions against trade in Luna, and was policy of Luna government to keep it that way. We invited immigration, unlimited, and pointed out that we had a labor shortage, and any immigrant could be self-supporting at once. We also boasted of food. Adult consumption over 4,000 calories per day. High in protein, low in cost, no rationing. Stu had Adam Mike stick in price of 100-proof vodka. 50 cents HKL per liter. Less in quantity, no taxes. Since this was less than 1/10 retail price of 80-proof vodka in North America, Stu knew it would hit home. Adam, by nature a teetotaler, hadn't thought of it. One of Mike's few oversights. Lunar Authority was invited to gather at one spot well away from other people, say in unirrigated part of Sahara, and receive one last barge of free grain, straight down at terminal velocity. This was followed by a snotty lecture which implied that we were prepared to do the same to anyone who threatened our peace, there being a number of loaded barges at Catapult Head, ready for such unceremonious delivery. Then, we waited. But we waited busily. Were indeed a few loaded barges. These we unloaded and reloaded with rock, with changes made in guidance transponders so that Puna control could not affect them. Their retros were removed, leaving only lateral thrusters, and spare retros were taken to new catapult, to be modified for lateral guidance. Greatest effort went into moving steel to new catapult and shaping it into jackets for solid rock cylinders. Steel was bottleneck. 2 days after our manifesto, a clandestine radio started beaming to Terra. It was weak, and tended to fade, but was supposed to be concealed, presumably in a crater, and could be worked only certain hours, until brave Terran scientists managed to rig automatic repeat. Was near frequency a voice of Free Luna, which tended to drown it out with brassy boasts. Terrans remaining in Luna had no chance to make signals. Those who had chosen to stick with research were chaperoned by Stilyagi every instant and locked into barracks to sleep. But clandestine station managed to get truth to Terra. Proof had been tried for deviationism and was under house arrest. I had been executed for treason. Hong Kong Luna had pulled out, declared self separately independent. Might be open to reason. Rioting in Novalin. All food growing had been collectivized, and black market eggs were selling for $3 apiece in Luna City. Battalions of female troops were being enlisted, each sworn to kill at least one Terran, and were drilling with fake guns in corridors of Luna City. Last was almost true. Many ladies wanted to do something militant, and had formed a home defense guard. Ladies from Hades. Huh. But their drills were of a practical nature, and Hazel was sulking because Mum had not allowed her to join. Then she got over sulks, and started Stilyagi Debs, a very junior home guard which drilled after school hours, did not use weapons, concentrated on backing up Stilyagi air and pressure corps, and practiced first aid, and own no weapons fighting, which, possibly, Mum never learned. I don't know how much to tell. Can't tell all, but stuff in history books is so wrong. I was no better a defense minister than congressman. Not apologizing. Had no training for either. Revolution is an amateur thing for almost everybody. Prof was only one who seemed to know what he was doing, and at that, was new to him, too. He had never taken part in a successful revolution or ever been part of a government, much less head. As defense minister, I could not see many ways to defend except for steps already taken. That is, Stilyagi air squads and warrens and laser gunners around ballistic radars. If FN decided to bomb, didn't see any way to stop them. Wasn't an interception missile in all Luna, and that's not a gadget you whoop up from bits and pieces. My word, we couldn't even make fusion weapons with which such a rocket was tipped. But I went through motions, asked same Chinese engineers who had built laser guns to take a crack at problem of intercepting bombs or missiles. One same problem, save that a missile comes at you faster. Then turned attention to other things. Simply hoped that FN would never bomb warrens. Some warrens, El City in particular, were so deep down that they could probably stand direct hits. One cubic, lowest level of complex where a central part of Mike lived, had been designed to withstand bombing. On other hand, Tycho Under was a big natural bubble cave, like old dome, and roof was only meters thick. Sealer on underside was kept warm with hot water pipes to make sure new cracks sealed. Would not take much of a bomb to crack Tycho Under. But is no limit to how big a fusion bomb can be. FN could build one big enough to smash El City, or theoretically, even a doomsday job that would split Luna like a melon and finish job some asteroid started at Tycho. If they did, couldn't see any way to stop them, so didn't worry. Instead, put time on problems I could manage, helping at new catapult, trying to work up better aiming arrangements for laser drills around radars, and trying to get drillmen to stick. Half of them quit once price of ice went up. Trying to arrange decentralized standby engineering controls for all warrens. Mike did designing on this. We grabbed every general-purpose computer we could find, paying in nationals with ink barely dry. And I turned job over to McIntyre, former chief engineer for Authority. Was a job within his talents, and I couldn't do all rewiring and so forth, even if I'd tried. held out biggest computer, one that did accounting for Bank of Hong Kong and Luna, and also was clearinghouse there, looked over its instruction manuals and decided it was a smart computer for one that could not talk. So asked Mike if he could teach it ballistics. We made temporary link-ups to let two machines get acquainted, and Mike reported it could learn simple job we wanted it for. Standby for new catapult. Although Mike would not care to ride in ship controlled by it. Was too matter-of-fact and uncritical. Stupid, really. Well, didn't want it to whistle tunes or crack jokes. Just wanted it to shove loads out of catapult at right millisecond and at correct velocity, then watch load approach Terra and give a nudge. HK Bank was not anxious to sell, but we had Patriots on their board. We promised to return it when emergency was over and moved it to new site, by Rolligan, too big for tubes, and took all one dark semilunar. Had to jerry-rig a big airlock to get it out of Kong Warren. I hooked it to Mike again, and he undertook to teach Art of Ballistics against possibility that his linkage to new site might be cut in an attack. You know what Bank used to replace computer? 200 clerks working abacuses. Abacusai? You know. Slipsticks with beads. Oldest digital computer. So far back in prehistory that nobody knows who invented. Ruski and Chinese and Nips have always used them, and small shops today. Trying to improve laser drills into space defense weapons was easier but less straightforward. We had to leave them mounted on original cradles. Was neither time, steel, nor metalsmiths to start fresh. So we concentrated on better aiming arrangements. Call went out for telescopes. Scarce. What con fetches along a spyglass when transported? What market later to create supply? Surveying instruments and helmet binoculars were all we turned up, plus optical instruments confiscated in Terran labs. But we managed to equip drills with low-power big-field sights to couch on with and high-power scopes for fine sighting, plus terrain and elevation circles and phones so that Mike could tell them where to point. Four drills we equipped with self-synchronous repeater drives so that Mike could control them himself. Liberated these Selsons at Richardson. Astronomers use them for Bosch cameras and Schmitz in sky mapping. But big problem was men. Wasn't money. We kept upping wages. No, a drillman likes to work or wouldn't be in that trade. Standing by in a ready room day after day, waiting for an alert that always turns out to be just another practice, drove them crackers. They quit. One day in September, I pulled an alert and got only 7 drills manned. Talked it over with Wyo and Sidrus at night. Next day, Wyo wanted to know if Prof and I would okay Bolshoi expense money. They formed something Wyo named Lesistrata Corps. Never inquired into duties or cost. Because next time I inspected a ready room, found 3 girls and no shortage of drill men. Girls were in uniform of second defense gunners, just as men were. Drillmen hadn't bothered much with authorized uniform up to then, and one girl was wearing sergeant stripes with gun captain's badge. Made my inspection very short. Most girls don't have muscle to be a drillman, and I doubted if this girl could wrestle a drill well enough to justify that badge. But regular gun captain was on job. Was no harm in girls learning to handle lasers. Morale was obviously high. I gave matter no more worry. Prof underrated his new Congress. I'm sure he never wanted anything but a body which would rubber chop what we were doing and thereby do make it voice of people. But fact that new congressmen were not yammerheads resulted in them doing more than Prof intended. Especially Committee on Permanent Organization, Resolutions, and Government Structure. Got out of hand because we were all trying to do too much. Permanent heads of Congress were Prof, Finn Nielsen, and Wyo. Prof showed up only when he wanted to speak to them. Seldom. He spent time with Mike on plans and analysis. Odds shortened to 1 in 5 during September 76. Time when Stu and Shinny Sheehan on propaganda, controlling official news to Earthside, very different news that went via clandestine radio, and re-slanting news that came up from Earthside. Besides that, he had finger in everything. I reported to him once a day, and all ministries, both real and dummy, did same. I kept Finn Nielsen busy. He was my commander of armed forces. He had his laser gun infantry to supervise. 6 men with captured weapons on day we nabbed Warden. Now 800 scattered all through Luna and armed with Kongville monkey copies. Besides that, Wyo's organization, Still Yagi Air Corps, Still Yagi Debs, ladies from Hades, irregulars, kept for morale and renamed Peter Pan's Pirates. And Les Estrada Corps, all these halfway military groups reported through Wyo to Finn. I shoved it onto him. I had other problems, such as trying to be a computer mechanic as well as a statesman when jobs such as installing that computer at New Catapult Site had to be done. Besides which, I am not an executive, and Finn had talent for it. I shoved first and second defense gunners under him too. But first I decided that these 2 skeleton regiments were a brigade, and made Judge Brody a brigadier. Brody knew as much about military matters as I did. 0. But was widely known, highly respected, had unlimited hard sense, and had been drillman before he lost leg. Finn was not drillman, so couldn't be placed directly over them. They wouldn't have listened. I thought about using my co-husband Greg, but Greg was needed at Mare Undarum Catapult. Was only mechanic who had followed every phase of construction. Wyo helped Proof, helped Stu, had her own organizations, made trips out to Mare Undarum, and had little time to preside over Congress. Task fell on Senior Committee Chairman, Wolf Korsakov, who was busier than any of us. Luno Hoko was running everything Authority used to run and many new things as well. Wolf had a good committee. Proof should have kept closer eye on it. Wolf had caused his boss, Moshe Abom, to be elected vice chairman, and had, in all seriousness, outlined for his committee problem of determining what permanent government should be. Then Wolf turned back on it. Those busy laddies split up and did it. Studied forms of government in Carnegie Library. Held subcommittee meetings, 3 or 4 people at a time. Few enough to worry Prof, had he known. And when Congress met early in September to ratify some appointments and elect some congressmen at large, instead of adjourning, Comrade Baum had gavel and they recessed, and met again and turned selves into Committee of the Whole and passed a resolution. And next thing we knew, entire Congress was a constitutional convention, divided into working groups, headed by those subcommittees. I think Proof was shocked. But he couldn't undo it. Had all been proper under rules he himself had written. But he rolled with punch, went to Novalin, where Congress now met, more central, and spoke to them with usual good nature and simply cast doubts on what they were doing, rather than telling them flatly they were wrong. After gracefully thanking them, he started picking early drafts to pieces. Comrade members, like fire and fusion, government is a dangerous servant and a terrible master. You now have freedom, if you can keep it. But do remember that you can lose this freedom more quickly to yourselves than to any other tyrant. Move slowly, be hesitant, puzzle out the consequences of every word. I would not be unhappy if this convention sat for 10 years before reporting, but I would be frightened if you took less than a year. Distrust the obvious. Suspect the traditional. For in the past, mankind has not done well when saddling itself with governments. For example, I note in one draft report a proposal for setting up a commission to divide Luna into congressional districts and to reapportion them from time to time according to population. This is the traditional way. Therefore, it should be suspect, considered guilty, until proved innocent. Perhaps you feel that this is the only way. May I suggest others? Surely where a man lives is the least important thing about him. Constituencies might be formed by
dividing people by occupation, or by age, or even alphabetically. Or they might not be divided, every member elected at large. And do not object that this would make it impossible for any man not widely known throughout Luna to be elected. That might be the best possible thing for Luna. You might even consider installing the candidates who receive the least number of votes. Unpopular men may be just the sort to save you from a new tyranny. Don't reject the idea merely because it seems preposterous. Think about it. In past history, popularly elected governments have been no better and sometimes far worse than overt tyrannies. But if representative government turns out to be your intention, there still may be ways to achieve it better than the territorial district. For example, you each represent about 10,000 human beings, perhaps 7,000 of voting age, and some of you were elected by slim majorities. Suppose, instead of election, a man were qualified for office by petition, signed by 4,000 citizens. He would then represent those 4,000 affirmatively, with no disgruntled minority. For what would have been a minority in a territorial constituency would all be free to start other petitions or join in them. All would then be represented by men of their choice. Or a man with 8,000 supporters might have 2 votes in this body. Difficulties? Objections? Practical points to be worked out? Many of them. But you could work them out, and thereby avoid the chronic sickness of representative government, the disgruntled minority which feels correctly that it has been disenfranchised. But whatever you do, do not let the past be a straitjacket. I note one proposal to make this Congress a 2-house body. Excellent. The more impediments to legislation, the better. But instead of following tradition, I suggest 1 house of legislators, another whose single duty is to repeal laws. Let the legislators pass laws only with a 2/3 majority, while the repealers are able to cancel any law through a mere 1/3 minority. Preposterous? Think about it. If a bill is so poor that it cannot command 2/3 of your consents, is it not likely that it would make a poor law? And if a law is disliked by as many as 1/3, is it not likely that you would be better off without it? But in writing your constitution, let me invite attention to the wonderful virtues of the negative. Accentuate the negative. Let your document be studded with things the government is forever forbidden to do. No conscript armies. No interference, however slight, with freedom of press, or speech, or travel, or assembly, or of religion, or of instruction, or communication, or occupation. No involuntary taxation. Comrades, if you were to spend 5 years in a study of history, while thinking of more and more things that your government should promise never to do, and then let your constitution be nothing but those negatives, I would not fear the outcome. What I fear most are affirmative actions of sober and well-intentioned men, granting to government powers to do something that appears to need doing. Please remember always that the Lunar Authority was created from the noblest of purposes by just such sober and well-intentioned men, all popularly elected. And with that thought, I leave you to your labors. Thank you.
Gospodin President, question of information. You said no involuntary taxation. Then how do you expect us to pay for things? Constafel.
Goodness me, sir, that's your problem. I can think of several ways. Voluntary contributions, just as churches support themselves. Government-sponsored lotteries, to which no one need subscribe. Or perhaps you congressmen should dig down into your own pouches and pay for whatever is needed. And that would be one way to keep government
down in size to its indispensable functions, whatever they may be, if indeed there are any. I would be satisfied to have the golden rule be the only law. I see no need for any other, nor for any method of enforcing it. But if you really believe that your neighbors must have laws for their own good, why shouldn't you pay for it? Comrades, I beg you, do not resort to compulsory taxation. There is no worse tyranny than to force a man to pay for what he does not want merely because you think it would be good for him.
Prof bowed and left. Stu and I followed. Once in an otherwise empty capsule, I tackled him. Prof, I liked much that you said. But about taxation, aren't you talking one thing and doing another? Who do you think is going to pay for all this spending we're doing?
He was silent long moments, then said, Manuel, my only ambition is to reach the day when I can stop pretending to be a chief executive.
Is no answer.
You have put your finger on the dilemma of all government, and the reason I am an anarchist. The power to tax, once conceded, has no limits. It contains until it destroys. I was not joking when I told them to dig into their own pouches. It may not be possible to do away with government. Sometimes I think that government is an inescapable disease of human beings. But it may be possible to keep it small and starved and inoffensive. And can you think of a better way than by requiring the governors themselves to pay the costs of their antisocial hobby?
Still doesn't say how to pay for what we are doing now.
How, Manuel? You know how we are doing it. We're stealing it. I'm neither proud of it nor ashamed. It's the means we have. If they ever catch on, they may eliminate us, and that I am prepared to face. At least, in stealing, we have not created the villainous precedent of taxation.
Prof, I hate to say this.
Then why say it?
Because, damn it, I mean it as deeply as you are, and want to see that money paid back. Hate to say it, but what you just said sounds like hypocrisy.
He chuckled.
My dear Manuel, has it taken you all these years to decide that I am a hypocrite?
Then you admit it?
No, but if it makes you feel better to think that I am one, you are welcome to use me as your scapegoat. But I am not a hypocrite to myself, because I was aware the day we declared the revolution that we would need much money and would have to steal it. It did not trouble me because I considered it better than food riots 6 years hence, cannibalism innate. I made my choice and have no regrets.
I shut up, silenced but not satisfied.
Stu said, Professor, I'm glad to hear that you are anxious to stop being president.
So, you share our comrades' misgivings?
Only in parts. Having been born to wealth, stealing doesn't fret me as much as it does him. But now that Congress has taken up the matter of a constitution, I intend to find time to attend sessions. I plan to nominate you for king.
Prof looked shocked.
Sir, if nominated, I shall repute it. If elected, I shall abdicate.
Don't be in a hurry. It might be the only way to get the sort of constitution you want, and that I want too, with about your own mild lack of enthusiasm. You could be proclaimed a king, and the people would take you. Walloonies aren't wedded to a republic. They'd love the idea. Ritual and robes and a court and all that.
No.
Yada. When the time comes, you won't be able to refuse. Because we need a king, and there isn't another candidate who can be accepted. Bernardo the First, King of Luna and Emperor of the Surrounding Species.
Stuart, I must ask you to stop. I'm becoming quite ill.
You'll get used to it, I'm a royalist because I'm a Democrat. I shan't let your reluctance thwart the idea any more than you let stealing stop you.
I said, halt it, Stu. You said you are a royalist because you're a Democrat?
Of course. A king is the people's only protection against a tyranny, especially against the worst of all tyrants, themselves. Prof would be ideal for the job, because he does not want the job. His only shortcoming is that he is a bachelor with no heir. We'll fix that. I'm going to name you as his heir. Crown Prince, His Royal Highness Prince Manuel de la Paz, Duke of Luna City, Admiral General of the Armed Forces and Protector of the Weak.
I stared, then buried face in hands. Oh, Bog.
Book 3. Tannstoffel. 23.
Monday, 12 October, 2076. About 1900, I was headed home after a hard day of nonsense in our offices in Raffles. Delegation of grain farmers wanted to see Prof, and I had been called back because he was in Hong Kong Luna. Was rude to them. Had been 2 months of embargo, and FN had never done us favor of being sufficiently nasty. Mostly they had ignored us, made no reply to our claims. I suppose to do so would have been to recognize us. Stu and Sheenie and Prof had been hard put to slant news from Earthside to keep up a warlike spirit. At first, everybody kept his pieces handy. They wore them, helmets on their arms, going to and from work in corridors. But then slacked off as days went by and did not seem to be any danger. Peace suit is nuisance when you don't need it. So bulky. Presently, tap rooms began to display signs, no peace suits inside. If a loony can't stop for half a liter on way home because of peace suit, he'll leave it home, or at station, or wherever he needs it most. My word, had neglected matter myself that day. Got this call to go back to office, and was halfway there before I remembered. I just reached easement lock 13, when I heard and felt a sound that scares a loony more than anything else. A chuff, in distance, followed by a draft. Was into lock almost without undogging, then balanced pressures and threw. Dogged it behind me and ran for our home lock. Threw it and shouting, "Peace suits, everybody! Get boys in from tunnels and close all airtight doors!" Mom and Mila were only adults in sight. Both looked startled, got busy without a word. I burst into workshop, grabbed peasuit. "Mike, answer."
"I'm here, man," he said calmly.
"Heard explosive pressure drop. What situation?"
"That's level 3, L City. Rupture at Tube Station West. Now partly controlled. 6 ships landed, L City under attack."
"What?"
"Let me finish, man. 6 transports landed, L City under attack by troops. Hong Kong inferred to be. Phone lines broken at relay BL. Johnson City under attack. I have closed the armored doors between J City and Complex Under. I cannot see Novalin, but blip projection indicates it is under attack. Same for Churchill, Tycho Under. 1 ship in high ellipsoid over me, rising, inferred to be command ship. No other blips."
6 ships? Where in hell were you?"
They answered so calmly that I steadied down.
"Far side approach, man. I'm blind back there."
"They came in on tight garrison didos, skimming the peaks. I barely saw the chop-off for Lunar City. The ship at J City is the only one I can see. The other landings I conclusively infer from the ballistics shown by blip tracks. I heard the break-in at Tube West, L City, and can now hear fighting in Novalin. The rest is conclusive inference. Probability above 0.99. I called you and Professor at once."
Cut breath. "Operation Hard Rock. Prepare to execute."
"Program ready. Man, not being able to reach you, I used your voice. Playback?"
"Niet. Yes, da."
"Heard myself tell watch officer at Old Catapult Head to go on red alert for Hard Rock. First load at lunch. All others on belts. Everything cast loose.
but do not launch until ordered by me personally. Then launch to plan. Full automatic. I made him repeat back.
Okay, I told Mike.
Drill gun crews?
Your voice again. Manned and then sent back to ready rooms. The command ship won't reach Apostolinian for 3 hours, 4.7 minutes. No target for more than 5 hours.
He may maneuver or launch missiles.
Slow down, man. Even a missile I'll see with minutes to spare. It's full bright lunar up there now.
How much do you want the men to take?
Unnecessarily.
Sorry. Better let me talk to Greg.
Playback. Heard my voice talking to my co-husband at Mariandarum. I sounded tense but calm. Mike had given him situation, had told him to prepare Operation Little David's Sling. Keep it on standby for full automatic. I had assured him that Master Computer would keep standby computer programmed, and shift would be made automatically if communication was broken. I also told him that he must take command and use own judgment if communication was lost and not restored after 4 hours. Listen to Earthside radio and make up own mind.
Greg had taken it quietly, repeated his orders, then it said,
Manny, tell family I love them.
Mike had done me proud. He had answered for me with just right embarrassed choke.
I'll do that, Greg. And look, Greg, I love you too. You know that, don't you?
I know it, Manny, and I'm going to say a special prayer for you.
Thanks, Greg.
Bye, Manny. Go do what you must.
So, I went and did what I had to do. Mike had played my role as well or better than I could. Finn, when he could be reached, would be handled by Adam. So I left, fast, calling out Greg's message of love to Mum. She had pissuited and riled Grandpa and suited him in, first time in years. So I went out, helmet closed and laser gun in hand, and reached Lock 13 and found it blind-dogged from other side with nobody in sight through bullseye. All correct, per drill. Except still Yagi in charge of that lock should have been in sight. Did no good to pound. Finally went back way I had come, and on through our home, through our vegetable tunnels, and up to our private surface lock leading to our solar battery. And found a shadow on its bullseye when should have been scalding sunlight. Damn Terran ship had landed on Davis' surface. Its jacks formed a giant tripod over me. Was staring up at jets. Back down fast and out of there, blind-dogging both hatches, then blind-dogged every pressure door on way back. Told Mum, and told her to put one of boys on back door with a laser gun. Here, take this one. No boys, no men, no able-bodied women. Mum, Gramp, and our small children were all that were left. Rest had gone looking for trouble. Mimi wouldn't take laser gun.
Don't know how to use it, Manuel. And it's too late to learn. You keep it. But they won't get through Davis' tunnels. I know some tricks you never heard of.
Didn't stop to argue. Arguing with Mimi is a waste of time, and she might know tricks I don't know. She had stayed alive in Luna a long time, under worse conditions than I'd ever known. This time, Lock 13 was manned. Two boys on duty let me through. I demanded news.
Pressure's all right now,
older one told me.
This level, at least, fighting down toward Causeway. Say, General Davis, can I go with you? One's enough at this lock.
Nyet.
Want to get me an earthworm?
This is your post. Stay on it. If a earthworm comes this way, he's yours. Don't you be his. Left at a trot.
So as a result of own carelessness, not keeping peace suit with me, all I saw of Battle of Corridors was tail end.
Hell of a defense minister.
Charged north in ring corridor with helmet open. Reached access lock for long ramp to causeway. Lock was open. Cursed and stopped to dog it as I went through. Warily. Saw why it was open. Boy who had been guarding it was dead. So moved most cautiously down ramp
and out on the causeway. Was empty at this end, but could see figures and hear noise in city, where it opens out. Two figures in peasuits and carrying guns detached selves and headed my way. Burned both. One peasuited man with gun looks like another. I suppose they took me for one of their flankers. And to me, they looked no different from Finn's men, at a distance, save that I never thought about it. A new chum doesn't move a way a cobber does. He moves feet too high, and always scrambling for traction. Not that I stopped to analyze, not even earthworms kill. Saw them, burned them. They were sliding softly along floor before I realized what I'd done. Stopped, intended to grab their guns, but were chained to them and couldn't figure out how to get loose. Key needed, perhaps. Besides, were not lasers, but something I had never seen. Real guns. Fired small explosive missiles, I learned later. Just then, all I knew was no idea how to use. Had spearing knives on ends, too. Sort called bayonets, which was reason I tried to get them loose. Ungod was good for only 10 full-power burns and no spare power pack. Those spearing bayonets looked useful. One had blood on it. Loony blood, I assume. But gave up in seconds only. Used belt knife to make dead sure they stayed dead. And hurried toward fight. Thumb on switch. Was a mob, not a battle. Or maybe a battle is always that way. Confusion and noise and nobody really knowing what's going on. In widest part of Causeway, opposite Beaumarchais, were grand ramp slopes northward down from level 3, were several hundred loonies, men and women and children, who should have been at home. Less than half were in peasuits, and only a few seemed to have weapons. And pouring down ramp were soldiers, all armed. But first thing I noticed was noise. Din had filled my open helmet and beat on ears. A growl. Don't know what else to call it. Was compounded of every anger human throat can make, from squeals of small children to bull roars of grown men. Sounded like biggest dogfight in history. And suddenly realized I was adding my share, shouting obscenities and wordless yells. Girl, no bigger than Hazel, vaulted up onto rail of ramp. Went dancing up in centimeters from shoulders of troopers pouring down. She was armed with what appeared to be a kitchen cleaver. Saw her swing it, saw it connect. Couldn't have hurt him much through his peasuit, but he went down, and more stumbled over him. Then one of them connected with her, spearing a bayonet into her thigh, and over backward she went, falling out of sight. Couldn't really see what was going on, nor could remember, just flashes, like girl going over backwards. Don't know who she was, don't know if she survived, couldn't draw a bead from where I was. Too many heads in way. But was an open counter display, front of a toy shop on my left. I bounced up onto it. Put me a meter high, then causeway pavement, with a clear view of earthworms pouring down. Braced self against wall, took careful aim, trying for left chest. Some uncountable time later found that my laser was no longer working, so stopped. Guess eight troopers did not go home because of me, but hadn't counted. And time really did seem endless. Although everybody moving fast as possible looked and felt like instruction movie where everything is slow to frozen motion. At least once, while using up my power pack, some earthworm spotted me and shot back. Was explosion just over my head, and bits of shop wall hit helmet. Perhaps that happened twice. Once out of juice, I jumped down from toy counter, clubbed laser, and joined mob surging against foot of ramp. All this endless time, 5 minutes, earthworms had been shooting into crowd. You could hear sharp splat and sometimes plop, those little missiles made as they exploded inside flesh, or louder punk, if they hit a wall or something solid. Was still trying to reach foot of ramp when I realized they were no longer shooting. Were down. Were dead. Every one of them. Were no longer coming down ramp. 24. All through Luna, invaders were dead. If not that instant, then shortly. Over 2,000 troopers dead. More than 3 times that number of loonies died in stopping them. plus perhaps as many loonies wounded, a number never counted. No prisoners taken in any warren, although we got a dozen officers and crew from each ship when we mopped up. A major reason why loonies, mostly unarmed, were able to kill armed and trained soldiers lay in fact that a freshly landed earthworm can't handle himself well. Our gravity, 1/6 what he is used to, makes all his lifelong reflexes his enemy. He shoots high without knowing it, is unsteady on feet, can't run properly. Feet slide out from under him. Still worse, those troopers had to fight downwards. They necessarily broke in at upper levels, then had to go down ramps again and again to try to capture a city. And earthworms don't know how to go down ramps. Motion isn't running, isn't walking, isn't flying, is more a controlled dance, with feet barely touching and simply guiding balance. A loony 3 years old does it without thinking, comes skipping down in a guided fall, toes touching every few meters. But an earthworm new chums it, finds self walking on air. He struggles, rotates, loses control, winds up at bottom, unhurt, but angry. But these troopers wound up dead. Was on ramps we got them. Those I saw had mastered tricks somewhat, had come down 3 ramps alive. Nevertheless, only a few snipers at top of ramp landing could fire effectively. Those on ramp had all they could do to stay upright, hang on to weapons, try to reach a level below. Loonies did not let them. Men and women, and many children, surged up at them, downed them, killed them with everything from bare hands to their own bayonets. Nor was I only laser gun around. Two of Fenn's men swarmed up on balcony of Bon Marché, and, crouching there, picked off snipers at top of ramp. Nobody told them to. Nobody led them. Nobody gave orders. Finn never had chance to control his half-trained disorderly militia. Fight started, they fought. And that was biggest reason why we loonies won. We fought. Most loonies never laid eyes on a live invader, but wherever troopers broke in, loonies rushed in like white corpuscles and fought. Nobody told them. Our feeble organization broke down under surprise. But we loonies fought berserk, and invaders died. No trooper got farther down than level 6 in any warren. They say that people in Bottom Alley never knew we were invaded until over. But invaders fought well, too. These troops were not only crack riot troops, best peace and forces for city work FN had. They also had been indoctrinated and drugged. Indoctrination had taught them, correctly, that their only hope of going earthside again was to capture warrens and pacify them. If they did, they were promised relief and no more duty in Luna. But was win or die, for it was pointed out that their transports could not take off if they did not win, as they had to be replenished with reaction mass. Impossible without first capturing Luna, and this was true. Then they were loaded with energizers, don't worries and fear inhibitors that would make mouse spit at cat, and turned loose. They fought professionally, and, quite fearlessly, died. In Tacawander and in Churchill, they used gas, and casualties were more one-sided. Only those loonies who managed to reach pea suits were effective. Outcome was same, simply took longer. Was knockout gas, as authority had no intention of killing us all, simply wanted to teach us a lesson, get us under control, put us to work. Reason for FN's long delay and apparent indecision arose from method of sneak attack. Decision had been made shortly after we embargoed grain. So we learned from captured transport officers. Time was used in mounting attack, much of it in a long elliptical orbit which went far outside Luna's orbit, crossing ahead of Luna, then looping back and making rendezvous above Farside. Of course, Mike never saw them. He's blind back there. He had been skywatching with his ballistic radars, but no radar can look over horizon. Longest look Mike got at any ship in orbit was 8 minutes. They came skimming peaks in tight, circular orbits, each straight for target, with a fast Dido landing at end, sitting them down with high G, precisely at New Earth, 12 October 76, Greenwich, 18 hours, 40 minutes, 36.9 seconds. If not at that exact tenth of a second, then as close to it as Mike could tell from blip tracks. Elegant work, one must admit, on part of FN Peace Navy. Big brute that poured 1,000 troops into El City, Mike did not see until it chopped off for grounding. A glimpse. He would have been able to see it a few seconds sooner had he been looking eastward with new radar at Mariandarum site. But happened he was drilling his idiot son at time, and they were looking through it westward at Terra. Not that those seconds would have mattered. Surprise was so beautifully planned, so complete, that each landing force was crashing in at Greenwich 1900 all over Luna, before anybody suspected. No accident that it was just New Earth with all Warrens in semi-bright lunar. Authority did not really know lunar conditions, but did know that no luna goes up on the surface, unnecessarily, during bright semi-lunar, and if he must, then does whatever he must do quickly as possible and gets down inside and checks his radiation counter. So they caught us with our pea suits down and our weapons. But with troopers dead, we still had 6 transports on our surface and a command ship in our sky. Once Bon Marché engagement was over, I got hold of self and found a phone. No word from Kongville. No word from Proof. J-City fight had been won. Same for Novalin. Transport there had toppled on landing. Invading force had been under strength from landing losses, and Finn's boys now held disabled transport.
This book is continued on Disc 11.